Invite you to share in a corporate reading together this morning, and then to listen to the words of a song. May or it may not be familiar to you, but it's Luke 14 and from verse 16 that we're going to read together. Okay? When he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, he went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day, as was his custom. He stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor." Only just come up. Let's start again. "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, and let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." And he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. And the eyes of all the synagogue were fixed on him. Then he began to say to them, "Today, this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." Thanks, James.
Well, they build their houses in preparation for the king. And they line the sidewalks with every sort of shiny thing. They will be surprised when they hear him say, "Take me to the alley. Me to the afflicted ones. Take me to the lonely ones that somehow lost their way. Let them hear me say, I am your friend. Come to my table. Rest here in my garden. You will have a pardon." Take me to the alley. Take me to the afflicted ones. Take me to the lonely ones that somehow lost their way. Let them hear me say, I am your friend. Come to my table. Rest here in my garden. You will have a pardon.
The singer is Gregory Porter. You may have come across him on various programs here and there. I have three of his CDs by courtesy of Sarah, Matt and the boys. And he has become quite a particular favorite for me. And if you're wondering about the hat, well, you'll just have to Google him when you get home and find out where that. But if you can reach the caliber that he has reached wearing a hat like that, you've got to be good. You really have. He's an American. His mother was a minister. And some of his compositions on, in many cases, portray something of his gospel roots. And Take Me to the Alley is the title track of one of his albums. And it's just a parable on the second coming of Christ. And I think he's caught hold of something quite essential in the wordings that he used. Take me to the alley, take me to the afflicted ones, the lonely ones that somehow lost their way. The prophet Isaiah, chapter 42, verse 3 says, "A bruised reed he will not break, and a dimly burning wick he will not quench." But Eugene Peterson, writing the interpretation, the message, he puts it this way: "He won't brush aside the bruised and the hurt, and he won't disregard the small and the insignificant, but will steadily and firmly set things right." He won't brush aside the bruised and the hurt, and he won't disregard the small and the insignificant. The second coming is something that is often ignored and is surrounded by an awful lot of embellishment, and I dare say an awful lot of questionable theology as well. And it is more embellished by people who haven't really got to grips with the real demands of Jesus' first coming yet. And I think there's a lot of them. I may have related this to you before. I have a friend who's the senior pastor that I worked with up in Yorkshire, Trevor Jones. And you would have to really know Trevor to get the essence of this. But he had some friends in Canada, and he went to share some of his holiday with them. And some of the Canadians, like the Americans, they have an absolute obsession with things about the second coming. And they wanted to draw him on what his views on it were. And he would not be drawn. He just would not. And they pushed it and they pushed it and they pushed it. And he said, okay, I'll tell you what my view is. It'll happen. That was it. He said, because you're missing the point. When Peter, in his epistle, addresses the issue of the second coming, he uses some what is known as apocalyptic language. But then he concludes like this: "But in view of all this, what kind of people ought we to be in leading lives of holiness and godliness?" It's all too easy sometimes to get preoccupied with the imaginary drama that may happen or may not happen. But what we ought to be addressing is the here and now. And what sort of people, what kind of people ought we to be? I like what Tony Campolo said about it. He said, "I'm not on the organizing committee. I'm planning to be on the welcome party. And none of you are going to be on the organizing committee because that's already taken care of. So you better prepare yourself to be on the welcome party." And it's not my intention to go down that road this morning of the second coming. But rather, what kind of people will he find when he does come? Because after all, if he wants to go to church, he's not going to be short of any variety, is he? I mean, for goodness sake, we've got enough of them already, whether it's mega church or cathedral worship, whether it's Hillsong, Vineyard, or New Frontiers, or whatever it is. Or he might like to go along to New Wine, or to Spring Harvest, or Soul Survivor, or he may not like to go to any of them. Because when you consider what he made of the whole lot when he came first time round, he may not like much of it at all, because he wasn't awfully impressed. He wasn't awfully impressed with what he found. He didn't think much to the temple, what it had turned into, what was going on there, the stuff that was happening, and he passed judgment on that in no uncertain terms. He upset them in the synagogue because we read a little bit of that customary visit that he made every Sabbath to the synagogue. You want to read the next few verses, though, because we read the nice bit. Everyone spoke well of him until he said something they didn't want to hear. He quoted the times of Elijah and Elisha when they were not sent to the people that the people who were listening to what he said thought they should have been sent to. He was sent to two people outside of the tribe, two people outside of the clan, two people outside of Israel, to an Assyrian and to a Syrophoenician woman. Not the right people at all. And by the time he had finished, they didn't speak well of him. They wanted to drive him out and they threatened to throw him over a cliff and kill him. Yeah, there's not an awful lot to be impressed about, is there? He went to a house meeting once. And he upset them there as well. Do you know the most common thing to do, the most common courtesy that you could give to a guest was to have their feet washed. The guy at the house couldn't even be bothered to observe that simple, common courtesy. And Jesus threw his attention to it and he upset them then. So he wasn't too impressed with their house meetings. And the religious leaders, woo! You wouldn't want to have been around and been a religious leader and got short shrift from Jesus at that particular time. So it's very likely that our church styles and our Bible weeks and our conferences probably just wouldn't cut it with him anyway. By all probability, our expectations won't be met. Will we be surprised to hear him say, "Take me to the alley. Take me to the afflicted ones. Take me to the lonely ones that somehow lost their way"? So, what kind of people will he find? For years, a lot of years now, within particular theological circles, there's been a debate that keeps coming and going. And the debate is about the Jesus of history versus the Jesus of faith. It's about the Jesus who came, the historical Jesus, the one who walked the earth among his disciples. Then there's the Jesus that they think the gospel writers have concocted 50 years later when they began to write about him. Probably didn't quite tally with the one that came. And then there's the third one that the church has created, the Jesus of faith, the one that they like to believe in. Well, somebody that's probably been reimagined. But throughout the whole of the debates that go on, they also seem to have missed the point. Because so often our discussions and our debates about things are just simply geared up to help us to evade or avoid the real issue. What kind of people? What kind of people ought we to be in leading lives of holiness and godliness? Well, we ought to be a people who have got to grips with what he came for in the first place. Because if we haven't got to grips with what he came to do in the first place, the second coming isn't irrelevant, quite frankly. You can forget it. Because what he's coming for, or will come for, are people who have got to grips with the reason he came in the first place. A people who are prepared to be surprised by him. And we will be, no doubt. But one thing seems apparent. The Jesus of Scripture seems to have become a little bit domesticated. A little bit sanitized, and I'm standing on a squeaky floorboard again. I ought to know better by now, didn't I? Or a phrase that Matt used quite some time ago, "We have laminated him." And most of you know what that means, where you slap something between two pieces of plastic and it becomes almost immovable. Safely placed between the layers of plastic, or in some cases suffocated between the covers of the Bible. This Jesus is far more radical than anything that we could perhaps ever imagine. Let me quote you from the Swiss Catholic theologian Hans Küng. He says, "Jesus apparently cannot be fitted in anywhere, neither with the rulers nor with the rebels, neither with the moralizers nor with the silent ascetics. He turns out to be provocative, both to right and left, backed by no party, challenged by all sides, the man who fits no formula. He is neither a philosopher nor a politician, neither priest nor social reformer. He is on a different plane, apparently closer to God than the priests, freer than the ascetics in regard to the world, more moral than the moralists, more revolutionary than the revolutionaries. Jesus is different. Despite all parallels in detail, this historical Jesus, in his wholeness, turns out to be completely unique in his time and ours. He turns out to be completely unique in his time and ours. I just want to take you back a few weeks. It was the 21st of January when we had the 24-hour prayer room. And I have to confess that prayer rooms usually throw me a little bit because I thought I got everything sorted out for today, even back then, and I hadn't. But somehow my son seems to have that habit of throwing me anyway. 24/7 prayer is not something that we own. In fact, it's not something that anybody owns. It began among young people in Chichester, and it's been going non-stop since 1999. It is now an international movement and spread into 90 nations. And the locations where youngsters are meeting, predominantly youngsters, I have to say, some are called prayer rooms, some are called boiler rooms, and they are very, very diverse. Some are in defunct church buildings. Some are in old pubs. But here's one that I came across just last week. Look at this. I love this one. Oh, yeah, dear James. No? Go on, again. There. The pop-up prayer room. Yeah, that's a good one. I love that one. The pop-up prayer room. I think it looks like an old VW camper or something like this. But the guy that, I was going to say, started it all, it's not quite true. It's a bit difficult to describe this chap. This is Pete Gregg. And something started. And he found himself as the, even hesitate to use the word, the leader of it. A bit like Martin Luther King Jr. He didn't want to lead that big movement out in the States. He just kind of found himself at the center of it and was dubbed as the leader of it and paid the price for it. This guy also pays a big price for a lot of what goes on. He's a very reluctant leader of this whole thing. If I could, I'd recommend to you some books to have a look at. One is called God on Mute. The other one is Red Moon Rising, and the other is The Vision. I want to quote a little bit of The Vision toward the end of this morning. But these, in some of these books, he recounts his own struggles of finding himself at the heart of this massive 24/7 prayer movement. And his wife is dying. And how does he correlate the two things that are going on? They're very, very honest accounts. And some of the accounts in the book are of people who are discovering a Jesus they have been denied the sight of. They are discovering a Jesus that kind of doesn't fit the formulas that have been imposed on them sometimes. Because what they are discovering is in these prayer rooms, the plastic coating's coming off. Jesus is coming out from between the suffocating covers of big black Bibles. And from between the suffocating covers of religious trappings as well. And many of them, they grasp what so many have missed for years. That simple, uncluttered, unfettered meeting with the biblical Jesus. That they don't care really what the theologians are debating. They don't really care what church folk are coming and doing or not coming and doing. They're just simply discovering an encounter and an ongoing relationship with this uncluttered Jesus, the one who doesn't brush aside the bruised and the hurt or disregard the small and insignificant, but steadily and firmly sets things right. And it's all the more amazing when we consider some of the screwed up, messed up lives that many of them are and have been living. Christian Action Research and Education, known as just CARE, says in their recent prayer diary that 100,000 children run away from home every year in the UK. 100,000 kids run away from home every year in the UK. And it says mostly because of abuse, neglect, sexual exploitation or unhappiness at home or in a placement. And many of them, just like Jesus, can't be fitted in anywhere. They don't fit in at home. They don't fit in a foster home. They don't fit in a, whatever homes they find themselves in. They've got problems. Some of the problems have been created for them, some of their own. But it's some of these, some of the most difficult ones, who are finding their way into some of these prayer rooms. Because let's be honest, some of them wouldn't set foot in a church. The buildings are too imposing. The structures, the systems are alien to them. But they come into these places. I don't know why they come in. Or what draws them in. Because these are kids who have very often rejected faith, the faith that their parents had. And some of them return to the delight and the bewilderment of parents that somehow something's happened. Some have never had any religious upbringing. And when they go back to the parents can't quite comprehend what's gone on. That somehow this Jesus person has sorted out this screwed up life. Some are going in as nominal believers and coming out with a level of commitment that is would blow your mind. But isn't this what the Bible is full of? Aren't these the kind of encounters that the pages of the Gospels are packed full of? Folk of whom we know very little. We don't even know the names of most of them. Some are Jews, but that might matter something, and it might matter nothing at all. But there is no intimation of their knowledge or understanding of God, and yet they encounter Jesus, and something transforms them. One of the longest dialogues that we have in the Gospels is where Jesus meets a woman at the well. You know the story. You know it well, I'm sure, most of you. And what happens? This woman has a little bit of knowledge, and she tries to bring that little bit of knowledge to cause an obstacle. And then she goes back to the folk of the village and she says, come and meet somebody that tell me everything I ever did. Well, it's not true, he didn't. But it felt like it. Because it kind of does. And she brings the rest of the village and they say, and now we believe not because of what you said, but because we met him ourselves. A man at the pool of Bethesda. He laid there 38 years. 38 years. What's his name? No idea. But he encounters Jesus and it seems that he's not with his disciples this time. He's on his own. And he says to the guy, ask him the silliest question you can imagine. Do you want to get well? 38 years, what do you think? We don't know who he was, but things changed. Another account of a woman caught in adultery, dragged before him by the Jewish officials. And in many cases, we know little more than the incident or the encounter. But what we do know is that they discover that they can be more than they ever have been. And they're certainly more after than they were before. We do know, however, what the reaction of the religious elite was. And this is where we all have to be a little bit careful, that we don't impose our own little frameworks on everybody that comes along. There was a man blind from birth. His disciples say, well, who sinned, him or his parents? Jesus said, neither. And he heals him in a very unorthodox way. He spits and he makes some mud. Gross, isn't it? Eh? Rubs it on his eyes. And the guy finishes up being able to see. And the neighbours, the friends don't believe it's him. They take him to the Pharisees, to the religious rulers. And they question him. They don't think it's good enough, so they bring his parents in. And say, is this your son? They say, yeah. Well, what's happened to him? He's old enough, ask him yourself. And the thing gets a little bit, excuse me for using the word, but a bit snotty. And so they call the guy back. Let me just read you some of it, can I? It's in John chapter 9. So the second time they called the man who had been blind, and they said to him, give glory to God, we know that this man is a sinner. He answered, I do not know whether he's a sinner. One thing I do know, though I was blind, now I see. They said to him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? He answered them, I have told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples? Then they reviled him, saying, you are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he comes from. The man answered, now here is an astonishing thing. You do not know where he comes from? You do not, and yet he opened my eyes? We know that God does not listen to sinners, but he does listen to the one who worships him and obeys his will. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opens the eyes of a person born blind. If this man were not from God, he could know nothing. And they answered him, you were born entirely in sins, and are you trying to teach us? Huh? I think this guy holds a trump card, don't you? The man who was at the pool of Bethesda, Jesus says to him, okay, off you go. And he picks up his mat and he carries it home. And he meets the religious elite. Because it's a Sabbath and he's carrying his mat. This is not lawful for you to carry your mat on the Sabbath. Tut, tut, tut. I tell you, if I had been crippled for 38 years and discovered I was healed, I'd have not only carried my mat, but the kitchen sink and my wife as well. Well, maybe not the wife. And when he says on occasions, your sins are forgiven, who does he think he is? They cannot somehow put a bracket around him, a framework around him. Jesus apparently cannot be fitted in anywhere, says Hans Kung. He turns out to be provocative both on right and left. Jesus in his wholeness turns out to be completely unique in his time and ours, and if they couldn't box him into their systems, well, neither can we. I love the words of an old hymn. We don't use it here, but it's one that I kind of grew up with. There's a wideness in God's mercy, like the wideness of the sea. There's a kindness in his justice that is more than liberty. But we make his love too narrow by false limits of our own, and we magnify his strictness with a zeal he will not own. We may think that some of the present day encounters that go on are a little bit perhaps too easy. But you see, an encounter with Jesus, right from those in the Bible to now, are not about conforming to some church structure or some doctrinal dogma. Don Dickinson, who was one of the founding members and the first leader of the fellowship here. I remember him relating to me a story at the time when he was in the Brethren Church. He had been trained, I think, as a child evangelist. Sorry, a children's evangelist. And they were doing some campaign among children somewhere. And toward the end of the days that they were doing, a young girl came forward and responded to the message to accept Christ. And some of his team were doubtful about her commitment. And do you know the reason? Because when she prayed the prayer, she only knelt on one knee. Yeah. I mean, in anybody's terms, that's pretty pathetic. The fact that she brought most of her family to Christ in the next few weeks meant that they kind of had to revise their thinking a little bit. But can any encounter not be genuine just because it doesn't meet our criteria? You see, something many do not get to grips with the first time round is that God is quite able to do things by himself. He gives us the privilege of being involved, but he puts us in our place when we realize he actually doesn't need us. He is quite capable of doing whatever he does on his own. But there's a mindset sometimes that thinks, well, you know, God needs our help. Well, sometimes he just gives us the privilege of assisting. The late John Gowans, who was the general of the Salvation Army, used to write poetry. And one of his little snippets ran like this: "Your work within your world is something stunning. I do not see the half, but I'm impressed. I glimpse the edges of your great designings. I feel the rim and wonder at the rest. You call me fellow worker. Lord, that's funny. The title strikes a humoristic note. When often all I do is pass your spanner, and now and again you let me hold your coat. We have the privilege, but not the responsibility. He's quite capable of doing it on his own." A colleague of mine several years ago wrote a poem. It was just simply called "Let Me Tell You." It was very, very much in the era of the time, and I've kind of updated it a little bit with permission. And he wrote this: "Let me tell you of some Christians who were shocked and dismayed when they met some New Age travellers on their way to church one day. They disliked their appearance, their hair and style of dress, and mentally composed a plan to rid them of this mess. One day these travellers paid a visit to their meeting. The Christian folks were shocked to see that some of them were eating whilst they should have been at prayer, so they said, 'Please go away. Who do you think our services are for anyway?' For a while, all was peaceful. The Christians weren't disturbed. They felt quite proud to think of all the great unwashed they'd curbed. As soon as service started, they simply locked the door so no one interrupted when the preacher took the floor. One night, in walked a stranger. Don't ever ask me how. He walked into the middle. He smiled. He took a bow. He said, 'Friends, my name is Jesus, the one you've longed to meet.' They said, 'Young man, that's blasphemy,' and threw him in the street. So Jesus left the meeting and met the travellers in the dark, who asked him back to their place, the old bus in the park. He sat down to supper and said, 'Guys, this is heaven.' And when counting up his new friends, he found there were 11. They elected him as leader. He said, 'That's okay with me. But I wonder if you've much idea how hard it's going to be.' A traveller, name of Peter, said, 'We'll follow just the same.' And Jesus sadly smiled and said, 'Here we go again.'" The words from the vision say, "With blood and sweat and many tears, with sleepless nights and fruitless days, they pray as if it all depends on God, and live as if it all depends on them. Don't you hear them coming? herald the weirdos. Summon the losers and the freaks. Here come the frightened and forgotten. Sorry, this stuff just moves me a lot. Here comes the frightened, forgotten with fire in their eyes. And my feeble, whispered, faithless prayer invokes a thunderous, resounding, bone-shaking great Amen from countless angels, from heroes of the faith, from Christ himself, as he is the original dreamer, the ultimate winner. Take me to the alley. Take me to the afflicted, the lonely. Take me to the old bus in the park. But take me to those who grasp why on earth I came in the first place. And why? Because the world became flesh and lived among us so that we could get a look at him. So we could understand something about God. The message, again, Eugene Peterson interprets that the word became flesh and blood and moved into the neighborhood. You could almost wrap that one, couldn't you? But it's the opportunity to get to grips with the demands that he would make. The demands that say, so what kind of people ought we to be? And we ought to be a people who have got to grips with why he came in the first place. And those who haven't got to grips with his first coming will not have, and excuse me for this phrase, this is one of my father's, and I knew exactly what he meant. Those who haven't got to grips with his first coming will not have a cat in hell's chance of understanding why he came or why he comes for his second. It means getting hold of what he's doing now. Becoming the kind of people he wants us to be now. And when we find what he's doing, we join in. Because there's little chance of us being more of anything unless we do. Jonathan's going to lead us in a song, and then I just want to conclude with a prayer that I would like us to say together.